So Brent opened the service this morning with a verse from Jeremiah. The verse, it begins this way. It says, "Thus says the Lord, stand by the roads and look and ask for the ancient paths where the good way is and walk in it and find rest for your souls." It was a call from God to his people that he loved that had drifted far away from him, so far away from him that judgment was at the door. And as he was speaking of the judgment that was to come, the things that were going to happen to them because of their distance from him, he cried out to them and he says, "Go back to the old paths. They haven't changed. Do what you did at first." And to the Israelites, it was a call back to the promises that were given to David, to the law that was given to Moses, to the covenant that was given to Abraham. For us, this morning we're going to see Isaac go back to the old past. We're going to see him walking in the steps of his father. He's going to be doing the things his father did, and we're going to see that God deals with him in the same way. And the reason I think that's relevant is so oftentimes, I saw when I was younger, I see it in some of the young people, we want to chart a new path. We want to find new ground and a new way of doing old things. And where do we end up? In the ditch, far away, saying, "Oh man, this path didn't lead where I thought it would." God calls out to each of us saying, "Come back to the old paths. I've given you a guide map. I've given you a road map. Here it is. It's not extravagant. It's not complicated. But I will tell you, beloved, it's new every morning. You're going to find new grace, new mercy." And so this morning we pick up Genesis chapter 26, verse 6. "So Isaac settled in Gerar. And when the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, 'She's my sister.' For he feared to say, 'My wife,' thinking lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. When he had been there a long time, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and he saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. And so Abimelech called Isaac and said, 'Behold, she's your wife. How then could you say she's my sister?' Isaac said to him, 'Because I thought lest I die because of her.' Abimelech said, 'What is this you've done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us.' So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, 'Whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death.' And Isaac sowed in that land, and he reaped in the same year 100-fold. The Lord blessed him. And the man became rich, and he gained more and more until he became very wealthy. He had possessions of flocks and herds and many servants, so that the Philistines envied him." Moses gives us a side note in verse 15. It says, "Now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father. And Abimelech said to Isaac, 'Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we.' So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water that had been dug in the days of Abraham his father, which the Philistines had stopped after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the names that his father had given them. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of spring water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, 'The water's ours.' And so he called the name of the well Esek, because they contended with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that also, so he called its name Sitna. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he called its name Rehoboth, saying, 'For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land.' From there he went up to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him, and the same night, and said, 'I am the God of Abraham your father. Fear not, for I am with you, and will bless you, and multiply your offspring, for my servant Abraham's sake.' So he built an altar there, and he called upon the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. When Abimelech went to him from Gerar with Ahuzath his advisor and Phicol the commander of his army, Isaac said to them, 'Why have you come to me, seeing that you hate me and have sent me away from you?' And they said, 'Well, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you.' So we said, 'Let there be a sworn pact between us, between you and us, and let us make covenant with you that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. For you are now the blessed of the Lord.' So he made them a feast, and they ate and they drank. And in the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths, and Isaac sent them out on their way, and they departed from him in peace. And that same day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they had dug and said to him, "We found water." And he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. It's interesting, those last two verses, they seem to not fit, but we're going to talk about that at the end. Hopefully, if we get there. Throughout this entire chapter, I hope you notice something. At the very beginning of the chapter, it begins with God reaffirming his promise. And what does he say? "I will be with you always. I will be with you when you go." In the middle of the chapter, in the midst of his life, in the midst of the circumstance, what does God come and meet with him? He says, "I am with you. Fear not. I am with you and am blessing you." And at the end of the chapter, what do we find? There's evidence that others can see that truly God had been with him. That's one of the things that captures this life that Isaac's walking as he retraces his father's steps. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that God was with him and was blessing him all the way. He would be with him, and he was with him, and it was evidence that he had been with him all the time. And that same promise, beloved, is given to us by God's Son. Remember when he sent his Spirit to bear witness to us of this truth. "I will be with you even to the end of the age." It's something this morning that you should take home with you. It's something that informs everything that we're learning in this chapter. We forget that sometimes. We turn on the news, we hear something we don't like, and we turn it off, and we're like, "Oh, he is with you." You get news from the doctor that isn't good. He's with you. You lose your job. You gain a job. You get a promotion. Something goes great. Something goes wrong. He's with you. He never leaves you. He never forsakes you. He is always there. And him being always there is such a blessing. I heard someone say this week, "This Thanksgiving, I don't know what we would give thanks for." Obviously, someone that doesn't know this truth, right? We know this truth. He is always with us. I want you to remember that as we go into Gerar, if you were to go back to Genesis 20, this is the area that Abraham and Sarah settled in near the time that Isaac was about to be born. And so he's back in Gerar. Isaac and Rebekah, it says that they settle down, and it doesn't take long before the locals notice something. She's beautiful. And we remember from the story when we met her, she's also good, she's sweet, she's hardworking. She's beautiful on all levels, very attractive. And so because of that, he lies about his, or he misleads them about his relationship with her. Now, some people, you'll read that they think, well, this is just a retelling of the old story. No, it's not. At the very beginning of chapter 26, "Now there was a famine in the land besides the former famine that was in the days." This is different. This is 60 years later from the last time that Abraham was here. This Abimelech that he's talking to is a different Abimelech. Remember, don't think of Abimelech as a name. Think of it as a rank. This is the king. Phicol is the commander. You start to understand that that's who these people are. And so this new king is here in this land. And so he gives them this misleading statement. Now, what is she to him? She's a first cousin. And if you want to get technical, the Jewish people are able to say for a first cousin that she is my sister. So he could say that with, but it doesn't matter. He was meaning it to mislead them. He wanted to mislead them. That she was not his wife. Why? Because he was afraid of being killed. Why? Because at this time, in this place, that culture still did that. If you had a beautiful wife and I wanted her, now it was horrible if I was to take a woman that was already married. That would be shameful. It would bring bad luck to me and the whole country. But if I kill her husband, well, then, oh, she's fair game. She's the prize. And now there's no issue. There's no problem. That was the culture. He knew that. It's the same culture that Abraham encountered. The circumstances are almost the same. And when you think about the circumstances are almost the same, what was God doing with Abraham when those circumstances were the same? Showing him his need of growth. Showing him where he needed to grow, right? We found out that he wasn't there yet. He wasn't full-faithed Abraham. His faith grew over time. And so what we see with Isaac is here's God growing his faith in a similar way. Needing that faith, needing that trust to strengthen. And so they stay there. They come to this place and they're able to stay an extended time. God uses all things and he makes them work together for good. For who? Those who love him and those who have been called to his purposes. Does that fit Isaac? Yes. So despite that he's kind of misleading them, God is going to work this for his good. And so we see it right off in this verse because he's able to stay there long enough that Abimelech can see him. He's there long enough that he can establish at least some rapport. And Abimelech was looking out his window. And as he's watching out of his window at them, probably sizing up Rebekah, you know, she's pretty sweet looking. He noticed something. Now your Bibles say that they were laughing together. I don't know exactly what they were doing together, but they were together in such a way that he was able to tell that they were husband and wife. Those two aren't brother and sister. And when he found that out, he calls them in. Why would you say she is your sister? In order to preserve my life, someone would have killed me to get to her. And Abimelech kind of admonishes Isaac and he says, you know, someone might have gone into her. The Hebrew says, someone was coming very close to laying with her. And so he tells him, he says, this has been horrible. And he put out the word no one. And so what happens is God uses this. And so what he does, he's so upset by this almost close call that he goes out and he puts a proclamation out to everybody in the land. No one can touch these two. You can't touch them. You can't harm them. They're under the king's protection, under threat of death. Look what God's doing. Now, they're able to go out and settle in a place that's kind of the rough, wild, wild west, right? And they're able to settle in a place with the king's protection. No one's going to molest them. No one's going to mess with them. God's hand is at work. And so what do they do? What's the first thing they do is they plant seeds in the land. They plant. Now stop for a moment. So often when you're reading your Bibles, you just go, okay, they're planted. Why are they there? Do you remember? Well, because God said, I want you to go to Gerar, but why did he tell them to go to Gerar? Because he said, don't go to Egypt. Why were they going to go to Egypt? Because there's a famine in the land. This is a time of drought. You don't plant seeds in a time of drought. This is crazy. And so you stop for a second and say, these people are in this land and they're planting. This is not what people do in the midst of a drought. Why are they planting? Because God is with them. They have God with them and God is going to bless them. And so they plant despite the hard, dry ground. I love the rabbis, the Jews, they teach on this passage that one, Isaac is walking in his father's footsteps. Two, just like father, just like son. Three, Isaac is believing, starting to trust, starting to grow in his faith and obedience. God told him to go here and he went there. God told him he would bless him and so he plants. That's what you do. God's going to bless me. Well, I'm going to sow this seed. He said he would. And what the Jews teach is they were able to show what it looks like to walk with a God who's present in your life. Wow. It hits me when I read something like that. Do I walk in a way, do I live my life in such a way that people recognize that I have a God who is active in my life? Or do we look like everybody else? He's called to sojourn in the land, and it's a land of threatening customs, a culture that's very different from his own. Once there, God moves in the very circumstances in such a way to mitigate the danger. Right? He's in this dangerous land. This is a culture very different than his. And then while he's there in that place, he doesn't do what the culture around him is doing. No, he does something counterculture. He does something completely. He's planting. Can you imagine the people going, "You're planting in a drought. Don't you realize that that's fruitless? It's worthless. You're wasting your time. This is hard, dry ground. Nothing will grow here." But under the protective hand of God, they engaged in a lifestyle that the culture thinks is worthless and fruitless. Why? Because this is God's way. This is what God wants with his people. This is how we live lives that draw others to him. This is how we live lives that convict others about him. You know, I stop here for a second and let me add this, right? Deuteronomy 7, the Lord called them out as his people. So you got to think, we always think about these Israelites, they're God's chosen people, they're beloved of him, they're the apple of his eye. And Deuteronomy tells them, "You're a people, holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, to be his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than the other peoples. No, you were the fewest of all the peoples. It was because the Lord loved you." That's what it says. Old Testament. "It was because the Lord loved you. And being in the center of God's love," right? What you find as you read through, being in the center of God's love, being the object of his love, isn't always roses, right? It isn't always easy. He told them in Amos, "You only have I chosen of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your sins." It's great to be a child of God. He's watching you all the time and he chastises you and he corrects you. So what's the reason? Is that we know that through them a blessing is going to come to every family on the earth. This was who he chose. It's going to come through this line. But as you study Israel through the scriptures in the Old Testament, we don't learn so much how steadfast and loving and committed they are to God, do we? No, what we find is how steadfast and loving and grace-filled God is to them. They were to be held up as an example so people would look at them and see him, to see what it is to be his. An example, a testimony of God's grace and his love and his mercy, his long-suffering and his judgment and his justice and, you know, all of those things. This would be the people that he would show the world what it is to be mine. Again, beloved, do you live a life that shows the world what it is to be his? Yeah, we don't do too well with that sometimes. To be a people that demonstrates God's steadfast love and his blessing. And so, his people who trust him walk in his way. And these people, Isaac and Rebekah, who trust him and do walk in his way, and our counterculture, they plant a field. They sow seed. With everyone going, "Oh my gosh." Can you imagine their faces within that year, within that season? The yield was 100-fold. What? 100-fold. I take a second just to tell you, that's important, right? 100-fold. Do you remember where we've heard that a couple times in the scriptures before? Mark's gospel, he gives the parable of the sower. Remember, and Jesus is speaking about the teaching of God's word, the preaching of the gospel. Some of it was sown on hard path, hard, dry ground. Dirty birds come and eat it all up. Jesus says that is Satan, who people will hear the truth and then they'll not take it in, and so very quickly it just is snatched away from them, and by the time they get home, they've forgotten everything that they've heard. Then there's some of the seed that falls on rocky soil. It grows really fast, but there's no root, so it gets burnt up in the sun. At the first sign of trouble, it's ditched. Some was sown among the thorns. Gets choked out. Jesus tells us those are the folks that, one, have concerns about the world and all of its things, and that distracts them. Some have desires for everything in the world, and that distracts them. But it's this world's concerns and desires that choke out the effectiveness, the fruitfulness of the seed. But there is a soil. It's a prepared soil. God's good soil. And when it falls there, 30-fold, 60-fold, even 100-fold. And when you get 100-fold, do you know what there's no doubt of? Who did it? There's no doubt when you see 100-fold in the same year. There's no doubt who did it. It wasn't Isaac and Rebekah. It wasn't their great farming skills. It was the God who blessed them. That's what you see when you see 100-fold. It's the evidence of God's involvement. It's the evidence of God's presence. One other place we see a return of 100-fold. Mark 10. It occurs right after the rich young ruler walks away and he's sorrowful because he wouldn't give up what he had in order to follow Jesus because he had so much. Mark, turn to Mark 10. Mark 10, verse 28. Peter talks. You know, and they're going, wow, that's pretty rough. That would have been cool to have that rich young ruler come in here and everything else, and he left because he had so much. And then Peter, good old Peter, speaks up. And he says to Jesus, see, we've left everything and followed you. And Jesus said, truly, I say to you, there's no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel who will not receive what? 100-fold now in this time. Houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands. Not only here, but even more to come. I always think of Harry, one of the guys when we first came to this church, he wore a little bow tie and he sat right there. And whenever you'd shake his hand in the morning, he'd had one thing he'd always say, all this and heaven too. Anyone that knew Harry knew that that was the greeting you were going to get from Harry. 100-fold. And you know what's interesting about the 100-fold? It's never earned. It's received. And it's always evidence that God did this. And what is it that they were doing when God did this? They were leaving and cleaving to him. They were trusting and obeying him. And when they were walking those paths, when they were walking that path with him, walking before him in truth, his blessings were evident to all around. Paul told the Corinthians in his second letter that God is able to make all grace abound to you so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may what? Abound in every good work. 100-fold tells us all this through evidence that this was God's work. It was a supernatural blessing. Why do God's people plant in a drought? Because they know their God can bring fruit, even 100-fold. Verse 12 tells us that it was the Lord blessing them. And how much? Well, how much? He says in verse 13, look at this. They became rich, very wealthy, with possessions of flocks and herds and many servants. And now, I'll tell you, there's guys on TV that misuse this verse. They focus in on, look at all the stuff God gave them. You know what's interesting when you get into the actual language is that what we're found out is that he was made great. And then it says he was even made greater. And then it says he was the greatest. And what you have in this section here is a great, great, great. When we know that God is holy, 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 what do we know? He's holy. When we know that this guy was made great, 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 it was scary great. And you're going to see what I mean by that. So great that the Philistines began to envy him. And the Hebrew term here has a double meaning to it. It can mean zealous or jealous. Do you know what the difference is between zealous and jealous? When you're jealous, you want what someone else has, and it makes you angry that you don't have it, so you want them not to have it, and you want them to get away from you. You push them away. Ever feel that before? I have. Anyone who's a little selfish knows what this is like. I don't care if I don't get it, but I don't want them to have it. That's jealousy. Zealous is then it's like you want what they have, but you kind of admire them for having it, and so you'll do anything in your power to get it. One pushes away, one attracts. Well, we see what it does in this case. I will tell you as a side note, beloved, as you live out your life for Christ, when you're walking on the right path, you're going to elicit this reaction. Sometimes when people see God's blessing in your life, they're not going to want it, and they're not going to want you. They're going to not want to be anywhere near you. You're going to stop getting invited places. They can't have it either, and so they have an angry response. They resent you, and they're repulsed by you, and they just want you away. But sometimes there's people that see God's blessing in your life, and they're going to want it too, and they're going to want you to show them how to find it, how to get it. It's attractive. What is it that we should be looking for in the fruitfulness in our life? What is it that he's going to give us 100-fold, supernatural, so that people understand it's him? You know what? What we're promised through his Spirit? What did Jesus promise us through his Spirit? Love will be a fruit. Can you imagine us having such a rich love, 100-fold love? People would say, that person loves like no other. Haven't you been around those Christians that love in such a way that you go, that's not a natural love. That's God's love. I see it. Our joy in all seasons. Why? Because of him. You see those people that no matter what hits them, they still have this grounding. Peace in the midst of the turmoil that we live in. What a testimony it would be for all of us right now to have 100-fold peace being exhibited in our lives. Come what may, he's on the throne tomorrow. He'll be on the throne in January. He'll be on the throne in 2022, and he's going to be on the throne in 2024. Peace. What it would be if we had patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness. Wouldn't it be neat to have 100-fold faithfulness that everyone would know we're in a relationship that we're absolutely committed to? How many of you treat your relationship with God that way? Like we would never think of being unfaithful in our marriage. Do we have that same commitment that everyone would know? This is who I'm in a relationship with. I'm committed to him. When you're saying no to something, so oftentimes like, no, I don't really feel like it. No, I'm not feeling very good. No, I have this other meeting. No, I follow Jesus. I'm in a relationship with the Lord, and he wouldn't want me to go with you to that place. That's usually not what comes out, is it? Gentleness, self-control. Anyway, I want you to understand that the world would say, ooh, look, you can get rich with this God thing. Beloved, when we're in a relationship with him, oh, we're going to be rich. But it's very different than what the world would look at and say riches are. So we find out very quickly which of these people are, right? We come back here to the thing, and we're told, we're given this little side note by Moses in verse 15. And he says, now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham. Why did you stop and tell us that? Let me tell you something about the Philistines. The minute Abraham was gone, they said, we want all of that gone. A well, when you look at a well in Scripture, when you think about a well, we have water that comes into our house. We don't know how important a well is. But in a dry, arid area, when you plant a well, you're planting a city. You're planting a place where people are going to congregate. When you plant a well, you're staying there for a while. This is the place you're going to dwell. This is mine. So when Abraham died, they said, fill in every one of those holes. We don't want any of those things. And in the Bible, you find that wells are blessings. We don't want his blessings. We don't want anything to do with Abraham or his God. Fill them in. Make it look as if he was never here. That's what Moses lets you know. They wanted no part of it. Philistines. Look here. He gives us that as a note. And then verse 16. Neither does the Philistines today. Abimelech said to Isaac, we need you to go away from us, for you are much mightier than we. It's evident what's going on with you. It's supernatural. It's scary. And we don't want you anywhere near us, right? It says that we want this to be a part of us. No, we want you gone. We want you away. We start to see what this envy is doing. They're scared and they push him away. I was trying to figure out, have I seen that before? We've seen it in the scriptures. Do you remember the naked guy that's in Gerasene? He's filled with all kinds of demons, right? And the townsfolk are really scared of this demon, this guy that's demon-possessed. And they try to bind him with ropes. He breaks free. They try to bind him with chains. He breaks free. He's there spooking the city out all the time. Here's that scary guy down by the, you know, he lives in the graveyard. Jesus comes. Gets off the boat, face to face. Here's this guy. What does Jesus do? All right, let's get that out of you. And he puts all the demons out of the man, puts them into the pigs. The pigs go flying and they go off. How have you heard the story? The people put him out of the town because they're all pig farmers and they're going to lose their money and their income. Wrong. It's not what the Bible says. They come to see what happened. And they come up to the fire, and sitting next to Jesus by the fire, the naked guy's got clothes on. His hair's combed. He's calm. He's quiet. He's peaceful. That's the scary guy? Not anymore. He's the scary guy now. What kind of power can do this? And it says what? They rejoiced? They got the scary guy clean? No. They said they were afraid. They were struck with fear. And the next thing they said, you get out of here. And it tells us, because we all make our livings on pigs. No, that's not what it says. It says because they were seized with fear. This God who can do this to the scary guy down by the graveyard, he's scary. He needs to be gone. Here's another question for you. How many of your friends are scared of this Jesus? How can you be scared of Jesus? He's like, yeah, we went to this movie. We love the baby Jesus. Yeah, everyone loves the baby Jesus. You know, he's a cute little baby Jesus. Everyone loves the Lamb who came. But you better be darn afraid of the lion when he comes. He doesn't come back as a lamb. How many of the people that you interact with are afraid of this God because he's scary? The things he can do is bigger than anything I had ever seen. Our God is a consuming fire. They sent Jesus away. They send Isaac away. You know, this is just kind of freaky weird. You're obviously way stronger than we are. You've grown to a point where we're afraid of you. We need you to just go. Later on at the end, we're going to find out when he says, you hate me. They hate him. We want you out of here. And so he leaves, and so I need to pick up my pace here. And so verses 17 to 25, we're told that Isaac is moved along by the wells that he dug. And what's he doing? He's redigging the wells of his father as he's going. He's following the same path his father passed. And it's not just about going home and looking at the old path. It's he's walking the walk that his father Abraham walked. He's growing in faith. He's growing in trust. He's growing in belief with each well that gets dug. And there's water there. There's more faith and there's more trust and there's more belief. He's walking that path. As he goes and he opens up the ground there and the water is there. These wells that mean life. He's not just getting water to get him to the next place. He is declaring, this is my ground. He's planting a city here and he's planting a city here and he's planting a nation here and he's planting a nation here. And every time he puts a well, this is our well. This has been promised to us. This is mine. These people don't like that at all. So they quarrel with him. And so the first well that he digs, they come up and they quarrel with him. And he says, all right, we'll go on. And he calls that well Essek, which means contention, strife. Well, he originally called it what his father called it, but now we'll just call that well strife. Goes to the next one. The fight is bigger. And when he leaves that well, he says, we'll call that one Sitna, which means enmity. We're at war with them. They want nothing to do with us. We want nothing to do with them. We're at war with them. The third well, further out. I want you to understand this is further out. When it says further out, it's beyond where Abraham had gone. Further out. The people go, oh, there's nothing out there. Leave him alone. That well he called Rehoboth, and it means wide open spaces. It means expansion. It means the promise that was given to Abraham was this. The promise that's given to Isaac is this. The promise that's given to Jacob is this. And as to David, it was this. And as we get to Jesus, it's this. This promise of what's coming. It's expanded. It's here that they settle again. And Isaac said, here the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful here in the land. I want you to see that as he digs these wells, he's planting a nation. And as I was looking through this week, I did a big huge study on wells. It's actually pretty interesting, worth your time. You come to a new insight when you come to Jesus, what he says to the woman at the well. He says to her in John 4, whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst again. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of living water. Another well to expand. You ever thought of yourself as a well that's been planted? Don't think we have we? And if we think about that, I always think about the song. I learned it in Sunday school a long time ago. I got a river of life flowing out of me. Right? Everyone know that song? Spring up, oh well. What's it talking about? I've got the river of life. I've got Jesus, and I'm a well. I want to water other people. I want to plant right here a city around me. I want a people who are going to be expanded to the kingdom right here. This wells of living water that builds a life that in that song says is lived abundantly. From here, Isaac travels up to Beersheba. So he comes back, goes up to the mountain at Beersheba. And when it says he goes up, what's he going up to do? He's going up to worship. He's going up to spend time. He's going up to give thanks. It's about 20 miles. And when he gets up there to worship at Beersheba, this is the place where Abraham was. If you remember, this is the place that Abraham dropped a well in Beersheba. It was the place where when the people come from the Philistines, Abimelech and his people, and they said, you're really powerful. We want to have an alliance with you. We want us to treat each other kindly. Can you make that oath with us? He says, well, there's one problem in the area. Your people have said that well is theirs. It's mine. Remember, he gives them 7 ewe lambs and says, here, that'll prove that this well is mine. And so that well from that point forward is called the well of 7 or the well of the oath. That's where he's at. He's up there on this mountain, and God meets with him, and he tells him what? I'm the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not. I'm with you. I'm with you now, and I am blessing you. And I will bless you. And I will multiply your offspring, and I will give you all of this land. And from your offspring, there will be a blessing that will come that will be to every family on the earth. This is the place I made oath with your father. He makes that oath again with him. And as they come to that place, he'd send his guys out. Let's redig that well. And as he comes down off of that mountain, look who shows up. It's this new Abimelech with his commander and his advisor. And then Isaac says to them, what are you doing here? You hate me. Why are you here? What do you want now? You shoved me away. What's going on? What do they say? We can't deny that God is with you. His presence is with you. And so we want in. We want in. We haven't treated you badly, but they kind of did, right? But we didn't hurt you. We didn't kill you. We want your word that you're not going to kill us. What does that tell you? All of a sudden, what? They're not afraid of him anymore. Who are they afraid of? They're afraid of him. We want in with you so he knows we're your buddy, so that when things go bad, he doesn't take it out on us. And so we want an oath with you. And at that point, Isaac, what does he say? No, you guys were mean to me. And so you guys kicks him to the curb. No. He feasts with them. Come in, and he makes them a feast. Now, another study? Go study the feasts. When do you feast? Oh, when you're rejoicing because a lost lamb has been found, when a wayward son has come home, you have a feast. So now you want in. Let's feast together. And so they eat and they drink together, and that morning they leave in peace. And right after they leave in peace, the servants that were going to dig that well, they come up to him and they tell him, Isaac, what? Water. Living water. It's the word that the Hebrews use, living water. Now, the way they mean it in the living water is that it's moving water. It's water that's a spring. It's water that continues to flow. It's not like a pool that just gets stagnant. No, this is water that's life in it. Living water. Imagine that. You can go to the southern western portion, which this whole area is that they're in today, and you're going to find desert. You're not going to find a tree. You're going to have a hard time finding a bush, a bunch of rocks, desert, dry, blah. But you know what you'll find there? Ancient wells. They have 7 different places where there's ancient wells. And you know something really cool? They're still bubbling with living water today. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Now we have these weird 2 last verses. Why don't we leave it just there? Because God does it. Esau was 40 years old. Wait a minute, Isaac was 40 years old when his life took a turn where he got married and then kind of went forward. And so now his path kind of started at 40 for Isaac. And so now we have Esau at 40. His path is about to start. Where does his path lead? To Judith and Basemath, Hittite girls. You know what's really interesting? Beeri means my well. He goes to a Hittite whose dad's name is, this is my well. You think he's on the same path as his father? No, he takes a new path. He takes a different path. I'm not going your way, Dad. I'm going this way. And what does the Bible tell us? And it brought pain and bitterness to the heart of Rebekah and Isaac all the rest of the days of their life. Every parent that has a wayward child knows exactly that pain that they felt. It took a different path. What's going to be cool is we're going to open up and the next place, one of my favorite places, we're going to see Jacob. And guess what path he takes? He takes the old path. The tried and true path. The path that the Lord lays out. Why is 34 and 35 there? Remember when we first started 26? I said, you know, 26 is really weird. You'd think that it should come before or after, right? It's just weird because we started with Jacob and Esau, and then we go into this, and then we come back to Jacob and Esau. Well, guess what? These 2 verses here, this whole idea of the paths, you're going to see 27 open to you in a way that it hasn't before. It's needed to understand. And so for us this morning as we leave here, here's the questions that you leave with. What path are you on this morning? Are you on the old path, the trusted, tried, and true path, the path that the Lord lays out in his word? This is the way. When you walk before me, I want you to walk this way. Go here. Or are you cutting a new way on your own? I know, I believe in God, I know all that stuff, but you know what, I got a new way of coming to him. I got a new way that I'm going to follow him, and it's going to be really cool. And you know where you're going to find at the end of your path? Hopefully a roadblock with a sign that says, turn around. Otherwise, you're going to find a cliff that leads to a ditch. Get on this path. Jeremiah, God called God's people back to the old paths. He was about to send in all of these other nations to destroy his people, to knock down the temple, to take them captive out of the land. I mean, if God had lost his patience, he's at the point where he's lost his patience. And yet in the midst of that, what did he say? But if you just go and look and get yourself back on the old path. I love Jeremiah. The first few chapters of Jeremiah, I wanted to be a father to you, but you'd rather be orphans. I wanted to be your husband, a husband to you, but you'd rather whore after every other idol that's out there in the world. I wanted to be a king to you. Oh, but you'd rather have an earthly king. I wanted to be your God, but you'd rather carve one out of wood. You would think at that point he would say, to hell with you. Let the lightning and fire commence. But you know what you find in the end of each of those chapters, in the first few chapters of Jeremiah? But if only you would come back to me. So wherever you're at on your path, he holds it out to you again saying, hey, it's over here. Here's the path. Come on. I love you. You're going the wrong direction. Come home. And when you do, beloved, for us, when we're walking on that path, God is with us there. And his presence is evidenced there. It's evidenced every day in our lives so that people see that we're in relationship with something supernatural. We see something in them that's not normal. Hundredfold return and fruitfulness. Look at how they love. Look at how gentle. Look at how forgiving. Look at how compassionate. Look at how he cares for them. Look at their peace. Look at their truth. And some of the people that see that are going to go, get out of here. We hate you, and I don't want you to have it. I don't want to have it. I want you gone. If that's not happening in your life, you're not on the right path. But there will be some who are going to come alongside and say, Can you show me where to find this? God uses our lives to declare to the world who he is and how he loves and how steadfast he is and how sure he is and how true he is, how faithful he is. This week, on Thursday, stop and give thanks to this God who is present with you and evidences his presence every day. We have much to be thankful for, beloved.